workers. Women have been women's rights have been totally lost. By laws, they have been lost. By their status in the society, they have been lost. Our voices of the women are being silenced continuously. Our radio, community radio for women, was shut down by the government on June 12. They gave us different stories, and we still don't know what's the final story for silencing us, but we know that this is no democracy. Women cannot breathe. Youth are killing each other based on the sectarian ID. This is something we were not expecting. This is not democracy.
Younar Mohammed, co-founder and director of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. And that does it for our show here at The Hague. Special thanks to Mike Burke, Julie Crosby, John Hamilton, and Dennis Moynihan. Democracy Now! Is produced by Renee Feltzer and Mate Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Rambi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Anna Ozbeck, and Sam Riddell. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Thanks to Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, and David Prude. And a big thanks to our crew here in The Hague. We'll let them speak for themselves.
I'm Sean Huibrechts, head of the crew.
I'm Mark Ploen. I'm the OB van technician.
Hello, I'm cameraman Joe May.
Dave Lenneman, cameraman.
I'm Robin Rovers, and I'm one of the lighting guys.
I'm Tracy Vishnidat, and I'm doing the makeup here.
I'm Matthew van Gelt, I'm the director.
And I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us here in The Hague in the Netherlands.
KBOO Portland.
You can help KBOO end the spring membership drive early. Donate right now and be entered into the spring membership drive sweepstakes. One lucky KBOO supporter will win a prize package that includes a 6-month VIP pass to the Crystal Ballroom that allows you and a guest entry to every show, even if it's sold out, as well as access to the VIP viewing area. A 1-week artist residency at Southwestern Lodge in Seaview, Washington on the Long Beach Peninsula, $200 in gift certificates to the Portland Saturday Market, and 10 treatments at Working Class Acupuncture. For every $15,000 we raise between now and May 5th, we will remove one day from the spring membership drive, which will be from May 6th through May 16th. Thank you for your early support. All the funds raised during this time will be applied to the spring membership drive goal of $95,000. A donation is not required to enter the sweepstakes. For more info, kboo.fm/2015springsweeps.
KBOO is proud to partner with Hopworks Urban Brewery for their community tap program. Every month, Hopworks features a local nonprofit organization, and May's Community Tap is your community radio, KBOO. To celebrate, KBOO is holding a kickoff party at Hopworks Southeast Powell location on Tuesday, May 5th from 7 to 11 p.m. The whole family is welcome. KBOO will broadcast live from Hopworks, bringing you the Melting Pot and DJ Anjali and the Kid live from the brewery. Hopworks is located at 2944 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland, and everyone is invited to attend. You can meet other fellow KBOO listeners and consider having some food and drink. That's the KBOO Hopworks Community Tap Kickoff, featuring the Melting Pot and Anjali live Tuesday, May 5th at 7 p.m. For more info, go to kboo.fm/hub.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland may be close to a deal to relocate houseless rest area Right to Dream 2.
The Oregon House passes a bill to ban employers from asking about an applicant's criminal history on job applications.
And we get an update on protests in Baltimore over the death of Freddie Gray.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 29th, 2015. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. The Right to Dream 2 houseless rest area may have a new home, according to city officials. Portland City Councilor Amanda Fritz said that the city is working with the Oregon Department of Transportation in an effort to purchase land in the Central East Side District that the agency currently owns. The land comprises a slice of land on Southeast 3rd Avenue and a portion of Southeast Harrison Street that is sectioned off by State Route 99 East. Right to Dream 2 shelters dozens of houseless people every night and is administered by Houseless People. It has been a frequent target of city developers opposed to sitting what they consider a camp next to desirable property. The city also engaged in monthly fines until 2013, saying that the group was operating an unauthorized campground. The deal would bring to an end Right to Dream 2's stay on Northwest Burnside, where they set up in 2011, and the city's attempts to relocate them. Those efforts have hit a snag since developers in the Pearl District paid out of pocket in 2013 in order to scuttle a plan to relocate the rest area under an on-ramp of the Broadway Bridge.
In Salem, the Oregon House has voted in favor of a measure that would prevent employers from asking about an applicant's criminal history on job applications. The nationwide Ban the Box campaign calls for elimination of such questions, which they say act as impediments for those who have a criminal history from finding a stable life once they are no longer incarcerated. The bill would allow employers to ask about an applicant's criminal history later in the hiring process, but states that it cannot be used as a reason to dismiss an applicant who is qualified. The law also allows employers to ask about an applicant's conviction if it was related to the job that they're applying for, and would not apply to jobs which already require a criminal background check. The bill passed 33-27, with the difference being split mostly along party lines as Democrats favor the measure. The bill now heads to the Senate. Here's what some Oregon legislators had to say about the measure.
House Bill 3025, relating to use of information related to certain criminal matters.
Question now rises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3025A. Representative Nose.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Colleagues, this morning I am proud to bring you House Bill 3025 for your consideration. This bill will help our state take one more step toward making our workforce larger and our rate of incarceration smaller. Presently, people with prior convictions and arrests are forced to provide their criminal history on a job application every single time, no matter how minor the offense or how long ago the crime occurred. To that end, House Bill 3025 really only does one thing. It removes the box. The box from a job application that asks whether or not you've ever been convicted or arrested. It will not prevent employers from asking about criminal convictions or doing a background check during an interview or after a job is offered conditionally if no interview is conducted. Studies have shown that if you answer truthfully on an application and reveal that you've been convicted of a crime, you get called back for an interview less than half as often as equally qualified candidates.
Representative Kenemer.
Madam Speaker and colleagues, this is an interesting and difficult bill. I find myself with great empathy for what it's trying to achieve, and I think that's highly commendable. I also think that the bill is significantly flawed. I would point out three in particular. One is, but House Bill 3025 provides a private right of action for job applicants who feel that their conviction history was improperly considered during the application process. Second, subsection 2 says that a potential employer may not, quote, inquire into or consider conviction history of an applicant for employment prior to conducting an interview with the applicant, end of quote. In some instances, a potential employer will know the applicant's history. There are a lot of small towns in Oregon. There are a lot of other associations in our get-togethers. And regardless of whether the box is on the job application or not, if an applicant with a conviction history is known to the employer, it may be very difficult for that employer to prove that they did not consider that history before deciding not to hire that person. And number three, although many jurisdictions with this law contain exceptions to the prohibition against inquiring about or considering an applicant's conviction history, House Bill 3025 does not. This is of particular concern in situations where a job requires a standard fidelity bond, which a criminal background would disqualify a candidate from receiving, or for jobs that work with vulnerable populations such as children or seniors. I think this is an important bill, but this bill isn't ready to move on.
Representative Peluso.
Good morning, colleagues. I rise today to urge your aye vote for House Bill 3025. As you now know, I have worked in law enforcement for 30 years and balanced my career with heavy involvement in nonprofit work centered on reducing homelessness and poverty. I've seen firsthand the devastation that recidivism has on individuals, families, and communities. It isn't pretty. While many think of law enforcement as a crime response or serving justice, which is true, but an often overlooked goal is to prevent future crime. If an individual serves their time and takes steps to turn their lives around, we need to ensure that the system is set up to support these positive steps away from criminal behavior. For far too many, the ability to interview for a job is inhibited by that little box on job applications. We know the single most effective deterrent against reoffending is employment. This bill is the best choice to make sure all our constituents have a fair chance to get their foot in the door and, if successful, gain employment and a real shot at a stable future.
Representative Widener.
This bill should go back, and we should come up with a bill that truly, truly incentivizes businesses to hire people that have been convicted and offer a tax incentive for employers who can hire somebody who has a conviction. Let's stop treating employers like they're bad people, because if I run a daycare, I need to know what type of conviction that person had before I hire that person to work in my daycare.
And Representative Gomberg.
I think we all agree this is a bill with good intentions. And let me say respectfully to all of you that for me this is not an esoteric issue. I'm an employer. I read applications. I interview candidates. I make hiring decisions. As originally introduced, I had some concerns about this measure. I think a lot of you are aware of the concerns that I had and that they were drawing me to a point where I could not vote affirmatively on the question that we have before you. And I had particular concerns about the role of background checks in the hiring process. Madam Speaker, I wanted to thank our Business and Labor Committee and the chair of that committee for addressing those concerns and making some significant changes in this measure regarding background checks. And because of those changes, I find myself in a position today where I feel like this measure provides opportunities to people who need it without imposing onerous regulations, rules, and burdens on the people who do the hiring. I'll be a yes vote, Madam Speaker. Thank you.
The National Ban the Box campaign was started by ex-convicts and their families and says on its website that 45 cities and counties have passed similar legislation. In Portland, the city voted last year to eliminate a question regarding an applicant's criminal history last year and is currently considering a measure to do the same thing in the private sector. The Fair Chance for All Coalition, made up of over 50 groups in Oregon who support this measure, said that more than 32,000 Oregonians are either incarcerated or under court supervision in the state. KBOO's Mike Klepfer spoke with Charla Chamberlain, a co-manager of Sisters of the Road, who supported the measure.
Can you talk about Sisters of the Road support for the Ban the Box campaign and why you chose to support it?
Sisters of the Road talked about it and wanted to support the Ban the Box because we believe that everyone needs access to resources and jobs where they can live and thrive. Ultimately, forcing people to self-disclose really puts them at a disadvantage when they're trying to apply for jobs in a community, especially where hiring and employment is really competitive. There are so many people who can do work, and the fact that they may have some criminal record is really, they've done their time, they've done their due, paid their dues, so I think it makes sense that they should be able to reenter the workforce in a way that lets them be able to care for their families. Mm-hmm. I imagine that employers will still have the option of doing background checks, but I think putting that burden on employers is more just.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the barriers to employment that houseless people face and how that can also be compounded by a past criminal history?
Besides just being able to have access to jobs, I mean, when you have a criminal record, it makes it really hard to get a job. They often have to go through getting an expungement of some of those things in order to not have to have clicked that box and then that leads to housing issues too, because usually for housing you have to have work, obviously, to be able to pay for your place to live, and then that just is a domino effect of all various ways that people are able to find stability in their life. We support and recruit people with many diverse backgrounds. We have a philosophy of anti-oppression and working for systemic change for people experiencing houselessness. And we hire all our positions with all our positions in the cafe and in the administration, focusing on people's skills and their experience of living in the community. And that's and we don't have like a standardized application that has anything to do with what people may have, the life people have had before they come to Sisters, other than those skills.
Charlotte Chamberlain, I want to thank you for your time. For KBU News, I'm Mike Klepfer.
The latest analysis of Portland's arts tax shows that the program has been costing more money than the state planned on. One of the largest unforeseen costs has been sending notifications to people who have not paid the tax. Last year, the city spent an estimated $135,000 in postage and printing. When you add the additional administrative costs, the city has spent $750,000 this year alone. Administrative costs are supposed to be capped at 5% of the collected revenue. However, if you include setup costs, the city has spent an estimated 10% over the course of the project. The program has distributed over $15 million to local schools and arts programs over the last 2 years. Officials expect the cost of the program to continue shrinking as each year fewer collections notices will be required and the initial startup cost will have passed.
The Portland City Council today accepted the State of Housing in Portland 2015 report. The report examines housing data citywide and in 24 neighborhood areas. The city's report found that the number of housing units produced and added to the city housing stock in 2014 still falls below pre-recession production levels. Here's a recording from today's hearing with Commissioner Nick Fish, followed by Mayor Hayes.
What this report tells us is that if you are formerly homeless, working class, lower middle class, you can't afford to live in the city. And that's not the city that we want. And that has cascading effects, including eroding the base of our public schools, creating divisions, and ultimately, as Dan often says, leading us down the path to some cities that we don't want to emulate, cities of just rich and poor. We know the federal government is not going to be part of the solution anytime soon, and your graph about the declining federal resources is sobering. In fact, I understand that most of the candidates running for president on the Republican Party have suggested just abolishing HUD. So we're not, depending on the outcome of that election, it may not get better. We know that through that chart you showed us that there's a not so much a TIF cliff, but a steady decline of tax increment finance resources. They have been spent well, but they're not an infinite resource. So if the federal government doesn't step up, and if the 30% set-aside continues to shrink, we have to do something. And that may be a dedicated revenue source going forward. In the short term, it seems to me we should invest our surplus in helping people survive.
Again, I want to stress, as I did in my request to the Bureau and their follow-up, that we really look at what other bureaus can do and what other entities and enterprises in the city can do to synergize the strategy. Given the size of that challenge, those two converging beams of change, and the relative scarcity of resources, one thing we can do is avoid doing much more harm. And that's why earlier today the council considered and approved moving forward with ways to look at our zoning code and avoid the pernicious effect of tearing down a great $300,000 house on a perfectly good street and replacing it with $1 million house over and over and over, block after block after block across the city, and thereby gentrifying the single-family base that we have, really without planning to do that. That's a change we could make to more heavily regulate and mitigate that tendency in the market. We've talked a lot about demolitions. You'll be hearing more from me on that subject because I believe we should tax demolitions, and that should be proportionate to the lost value of the structure that's being demolished. If it's a house that's ruined and is never going to be restored, obviously there's not much point in taxing its demolition. But if it's neither of those things, then I think there's a good public policy argument for doing that. So there are other things we can do in policy and tax and action plans that make this set of goals and numbers more achievable. And I'm very interested in us thinking as a board of directors, as stewards of the whole city and the whole enterprise of all of our bureaus, about how we make those connections, as well as how we try to do more each year.
That was Portland Mayor Charlie Hales at today's City Council hearing on the state of housing in Portland.
Oregon legislators have taken a step toward putting new limits on medical marijuana growers in the state. The committee to implement Measure 91 waved off concerns by some medical marijuana patients that legalization of the drug will decrease their access. Members of the Joint Committee said they expect to hold a vote Wednesday on the measure. The proposal places new limits on the number of plants in medical marijuana farms. At the same time, the measure would prohibit cities and counties from banning medical marijuana dispensaries, although local governments would still have the ability to regulate their operations. Here's some of the testimony at the Oregon Legislature by Representative Buckley.
I think it's important to kind of keep the kind of larger frame, as Senator Brzezinski was just mentioning. We're trying to balance the concerns of neighbors who have been impacted by growing operations in their neighborhoods with the, I believe, fully shared goal of making sure that no patient loses access to the medicine that they deserve and they require. The idea for grandfathering in growers was to make sure that the grower-patient relationships that existed at the time of Measure 91 passing and exist now, are, as of January 1st, 2015, are kept in place. And over time, we get to limits that can be, I think, easily understood by growers, easily understood by law enforcement, easily understood by fellow citizens of a certain area, so they understand what the expectations are. And we'll also be discussing further on in terms of the tools that cities have in terms of time, place, and manner and nuisance. So we're trying to find that balance between making sure that no one who's in the program now is negatively impacted, but we all are also addressing the legitimate concerns raised by communities who have experienced impacts on their neighborhoods that they have concerns over.
In addition, medical marijuana growers would also have to comply with new reporting requirements and could face lower limits if they violate the rules. The marijuana legalization measure approved by voters in November says that the state's medical marijuana program would continue to operate separately. But legislators on the committee said that they need to put additional regulations on medical marijuana to make sure it doesn't undercut the recreational market.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for interviews with with Portland Public Schools Board candidates from Zone 3, conducted by KBOO's Joe Meyer, followed by Occupy Portland Radio at 6. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be partly cloudy, with a high of 71 and a low of 47, with just a 10% chance of rain. Today in history, in 1967, boxing champion Muhammad Ali was stripped of his belt for refusing to serve in the Army during the Vietnam War. And in 1992, riots swept Los Angeles after four LAPD officers were acquitted for beating Rodney King. King was a black motorist whose beating at the hands of police was caught on videotape. The riots lasted 7 days. There were 53 deaths, 2,000 injuries, and $1 billion in reported property damage. Our quote of the day is from Malcolm X, who said, "If you're not careful, the newspapers will have you hating the people who are being oppressed and loving the people who are doing the oppressing."
Protests in Baltimore over the death of a 25-year-old black man due to injuries he suffered in police custody continued last night. Baltimore riot police fired tear gas and pepper balls at hundreds of protesters who had gathered at the intersection of Pennsylvania and North Avenues, and there was no repeat to the rioting that gripped the city Monday. Baltimore residents are responding to the death of Freddie Gray, who fled police and was chased. An autopsy revealed that Gray suffered a severe spinal injury in police custody when he was arrested earlier this month, but city officials have so far refused to disclose their version of events. As a result of protests and rioting, the governor of Maryland declared a state of emergency on Monday, activating National Guard troops stationed in the state and directing nearby police agencies to send equipment and personnel to Baltimore. A citywide curfew also went into effect last night, with residents required to be off the streets at 10 p.m. Authorities have also used the state of emergency to suspend legal procedures, posting cash bail bonds for some of the 235 people arrested so far at amounts as high as $500,000. The majority of those arrested are still being held without charge. Maryland law states that if someone is arrested, they must be charged within 24 hours, a provision that the state of emergency suspends. Protests in solidarity with Baltimore took place in Chicago, Oakland, and in Ferguson, Missouri. Two protesters were shot in Ferguson in separate incidents. The police could not determine whether they were related to the protest. For more on the protest, we go now live to Baltimore school teacher Megan Harris. Good evening, Megan.
Good evening.
Can you describe to us where you were tonight and what was happening?
Yeah, I was at a peace protest with college students. It was a very large protest, hundreds of students from Towson University, Johns Hopkins University, as well as the Maryland Institute College of Art, and all of us were marching from Penn Station down to City Hall and then back to Penn Station again. Very peaceful, very loving, lots of people singing songs. It was a good experience.
And you were also an eyewitness to the beginning of the clashes between police and teenagers on Monday. Can you talk a little bit about what was happening then?
Yeah, sure. I was a witness because I was driving two students home. My students ahead of time already knew that something was going to happen because they saw the post on Instagram. When they saw the post, they started to talk about how they were really worried about what was happening. And I had two students who were going right through the area and would have to take buses. So I asked if I could drive them home, and their parents gave me permission. When I went to drive them home to Mondawmin, which was the mall where everything took place, there is a high school right there that lets out. It's called Douglas High School. And the students had just gotten out, but there were not many around. But right away, we could see that the police had shut down the street. When the police shut down the street, it took us about 30 minutes just to turn a corner on the street. When we were watching from inside the car, what we could see was that there were police in full riot gear. There weren't really any students around by this point, as I stated, but there were plenty of cops, all in full riot gear, face shields, body shields, batons. They were marching arm in arm with about 20 to 30 cops in a line. In addition to that, when we finally did turn the corner, we could see that there were buses all lined up, maybe 15 to 20 buses, and all of the buses were unloading all of their passengers because the police were making the passengers get off. We didn't see any police at the buses, but you could tell that they were evacuating the buses onto the street. So all of the passengers were being forced to stay in the area. On top of that, I heard later that they shut down the metro station. What people may not realize is that Mondawmin Mall in Baltimore is a huge public transportation hub where buses come and the metro comes. If you shut both of those down, people can't get around. In addition to that, a lot of Baltimore residents don't drive cars. They take the public transportation. Students in Baltimore, I don't know what they do in other areas of the country. I know a lot of people take yellow buses. In Baltimore, that doesn't happen. Students have something called an S-Pass, where they take public transportation because our students don't have zone schools. They come from all over the city. So if you shut down public transportation, they have no way to get out. So we saw a lot of kids kind of worried and nervous that they couldn't leave. We saw cops marching up to any small social group of students who seemed like they were just kind of milling about after school as normal. When we finally turned the last corner, we saw that there were a lot of students who had walked to the far bus stop to try to get out. Little did they know that there were not buses coming to take them. And in addition, on top of that, we saw that because they were sitting there, they were there when the rioters did start to come. And we didn't really see anybody who looked very vicious or anything like that. It was really just students running toward the area where we knew police were. But they weren't really doing anything. They were just kind of shouting and stuff. However, you could tell the kids were really nervous.
Well, thank you for that description. And we have about two more minutes. I want to get to one more question. A video has been making its way around the internet I'm guessing you've probably seen it, depicting a mother pulling her son out from the protest and hitting him repeatedly, ostensibly to punish him for participating.
Right.
Baltimore police in some instances have commended this mother for her actions, and it's being spread far and wide by the media. I'm curious what your take is.
Well, I have two opinions on that video, and yes, I have seen it. My first opinion is we didn't allow our parents to do what they would have done in that situation. So we're commending this one parent, but the call for parents to go get their kids was made rather late, much after the time of everything started. But along with that, students knew, some students knew since Saturday that whatever was going to happen on Monday was going to happen. They were calling it the Purge after the movie The Purge, where there's basically 12 hours of lawlessness. I found out at about 1 o'clock on Monday because I kept hearing my students say, the Purge, the Purge. And finally I went, okay, guys, what is the Purge? And then they told me, and then we started organizing rides home. So, you know, they knew about it for so long. How did people in the government, in our city council, in our school board, how did they not find out? And how did we not make the call for parents to come pick up their kids? We should have done something like kept the kids in the schools until a parent can get to the school and take their kid physically home with them, or organize ride sharing, or organize parent shares to get cars home. You know that after something serious like Freddie Gray has happened, that, you know, if students say they're going to do something, they are going to do something because they're mad and they're upset, and rightfully so, because this is their city. And he was a resident of their city, and many people are from the neighborhood where he's from. So, you know, if they say they're going to act, we should listen to students and actually pay attention to them. And I think a lot of people ignored what was going to happen on that day. Some people even knew what was going to happen, and they just kind of said, oh, they're not going to do it. But, you know, they didn't intend to do it. And I think we failed parents by not getting in contact with them, because we had one mother that got out to get her child. And I think a lot of other parents would have done the same exact thing. In fact, they wouldn't have had to go all the way to Mondawmin, because they would have known ahead of time and they would have picked up their kids. On top of that, yesterday I was at the Real News Network in Baltimore, and there was a very intelligent woman beside me. Her name was Michaela. I don't remember her last name, but she was talking about how in any other situation, if people saw that clip and it had nothing to do with those riots, they would have probably said, oh, well, look at this mother. She's abusive. And what does that mean about black mothers? And it's interesting to think of that and think about how people will turn a situation. In the case of this riot, people are commending her. But in any other situation, she'd be a bad mother. But people don't realize that she's just really trying to look out for her kids, and she has his best interests at heart.
Well, Ms. Harris, we're out of time. Thank you so much, and our thoughts will be with you and the citizens of Baltimore. Good night.
Absolutely. Thank you.
A poll released today by Harvard's Institute of Politics revealed deep cynicism amongst the nation's youth regarding the justice system and police. The poll of 18 to 29-year-old Americans also highlighted racial divisions on the subject of law enforcement, with two-thirds or more of black and Hispanic youths expressing little or no trust in their local police. About a third of white youth also mistrust the police. However, the poll showed that young Americans' misgivings over the integrity of the nation's court system cut across race lines, with roughly half of all responders doubting the ability of the courts to issue fair rulings. Young Republicans had slightly more confidence in the judicial system than others, with two-thirds maintaining positive views. Even so, the wider picture is one of growing skepticism and mistrust. The information was especially timely, given the ongoing mass protests and riots over the shooting of young unarmed black men across the country, including right now in Baltimore, Maryland. These events have spawned the hashtag Black Lives Matter movement on social media sites, but despite the attention it has received from young Americans, the Harvard researchers found that the majority of their participants did not believe it would result in any real change for the better. 80% did think that mandatory police body cameras would help reverse inequality and abuse in the criminal justice system. 3,000 young men and women participated in the poll, which also covered other social and political issues.
With the deadline for reauthorizing certain sections of the Patriot Act coming up, the House and Senate Judiciary Committees have introduced the USA Freedom Act, a reform bill that would reauthorize some aspects of the law while attempting to reform the way the government uses its spying capabilities. Privacy advocates offer mixed reactions to the bill, noting that while it is the strongest reform to the Patriot Act yet, it still contains worrying concessions to pro-surveillance factions, such as expanded penalties for those convicted of lending material support to terrorism.
Aid efforts continue in Nepal after a major earthquake Saturday that has killed 5,500 people. Today, the United Nations sent an appeal for $415 million in emergency aid in order to assist the Nepalese government for 3 months. It estimates that 8 million people were affected by the 7.8 magnitude quake, and the country's prime minister has stated that the death toll could reach 10,000. Aid efforts have begun in Nepal, but many people remain stranded without food, water, or shelter. Thousands of residents of Kathmandu today faced off against riot police as they were barred from leaving the city. Crowds had gathered at a bus station after the government had said they would provide buses for transport, but the crowd of people waiting became angry when the buses never showed up. Hundreds of thousands of people remain unsheltered in Kathmandu, either as a result of their homes being destroyed or in fear that their homes could collapse during an aftershock. Rescuers are continuing to dig through rubble in Kathmandu in hopes of finding survivors. A four-month-old boy was successfully rescued today from the wreckage of his home, as well as a man trapped in a collapsed hotel.
Today is an International Day of Action to stop the Mount Pauley mine in British Columbia from reopening. On April 1st, the province of BC accepted the application to reopen Imperial Metals, leaving 1 month for the public to respond. The Imperial Metals Corporation is responsible for dumping over 14 million cubic meters of mining waste into pristine waterways in British Columbia. These include the Fraser River watershed, which is the second largest salmon spawning grounds in the world, and located on the unceded territory of a Native American nation. The Native activists called for a day of action today, April 29, 2015, to demand that Mount Pauley not reopen. Here's a clip from their call to action.
The province has no jurisdiction to be making these decisions on our homeland. It's our people, the grassroots people, our nation that makes decisions on our homeland, whether we are going to allow this or not. And our people say no. But everybody needs to know that this is what it really looks like out here. That this is what Mount Pauley, this is what Imperial Metals thinks about us. They don't care.
When I worked at Mount Pauley, I seen some of the neglect there and about the environment, and I phoned the Ministry of Mines and I told them what the mine, the tailings pond was pushing out, there was too much back pressure, and I got told by this, by four or five employees, it seemed to me like a lot of people knew about this.
What happens here at Mount Pauley and how the government and how industry deals with this disaster is going to set a precedent on how they deal with other disasters and other spills, whether it's from mining or pipelines. This is what they think about us. This is what they think about our water. This is what they think about our land. And we cannot allow it. We cannot accept it.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, April 29th, 2015. A Palestinian man injured as Israeli troops attack protesters, and meanwhile, army invasions and kidnappings reported in a number of West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian civilian was shot and lightly wounded on Wednesday by Israeli troops at a protest against Israeli cancer-causing chemical plants in Tul Karim city, northern West Bank. Around 50 Palestinians and international activists gathered today in Tul Karim to protest the presence of 11 Israeli chemical plants located in the city. The protest took place outside the Gishuri chemical plant on what is locally referred to as the Death Road due to the health problems caused by the Israeli plants. The protesters were carrying signs demanding a clean environment and an end to the Israeli occupation, while Israeli soldiers deployed to guard the plant quickly responded with stun grenades and tear gas. Earlier, Israeli forces on Wednesday demolished a Palestinian-owned structure used for raising livestock in Rojib village to the south of Nablus, according to local activists. Ghassan Douglas, who monitors the construction of Israeli settlers' units in northern West Bank, said that large Israeli forces, accompanied by bulldozer, cornered off the structure belonging to Ala Araed and proceeded to demolish it, then left. Earlier on Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 9 Palestinians in Hebron, 3 in Bethlehem and 1 in Nablus. The invasion in Nablus led to clashes between local youth and soldiers. The youth hurled stones, empty bottles and Molotov cocktails on the invading army vehicles, while the soldiers fired rounds of live ammunition and concussion grenades. Moreover, Israeli soldiers conducted live training in different areas of Jenin City in northern West Bank. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, April 29th, 2015, News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Barnoura.
Pope Francis took an important step today in providing closure for the victims of Argentina's 1976 to 1983 military dictatorship. The Pope has ordered the release of the Vatican's files from that era, including messages sent to Rome from its ambassador in Buenos Aires, who had close contact with the military junta that ruled the country. Other important documents could include contemporary appeals from families of the victims to church officials. During the period when 3 top-ranking military officers exercised complete control of the government, an estimated 20,000 Argentinians were murdered or made to, quote, disappear for allegedly expressing dissent or holding leftist political views. The move follows a meeting last week between Pope Francis and a representative of the victims' families, Lita Boitano, who lost her 2 sons to the totalitarian regime. When Boitano petitioned the Pope on behalf of her organization, family members, she says that he personally promised to address her concerns and provide, quote, exact data on the disappearances. The issue is also a personal one for Pope Francis, who was head of the Jesuit order in Argentina at the time. Despite the risks, he maintained a personal friendship with an open critic of the regime, who herself eventually disappeared. Esther Carragea. The Vatican, under Pope John Paul II, has denied the same request for release of information, despite expressing willingness to do so eventually. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Nathan Behensky, Joe Meyer, Joe Aaron, and Galen Sanford. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with Dave Dahl of Dave's Killer Bread and small business owner Wendy Sample about mental illness and the upcoming Northwest 5K walk for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, also known as NAMI. At 9 o'clock is Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, host David Nyman speaks with Viet Thanh Nguyen about Sympathizer, his spy novel examining the legacy of Vietnam. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for interviews.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
And stay tuned now for interviews with Portland Public School Board candidates from Zone 3, brought to you by KBOO's Joe Meyer.
Portland School Board elections are May 19th. What's your question?
This is Hyung Nam. I'm a Portland Public Schools teacher. What do you think is the purpose of education?
This is Gretchen Hollins. I'm running for Portland Public School Board, Zone 3. To make good citizens, we live in a democracy, and an effective democracy requires educated, good citizens. Currently, students are encouraged to go to college, and I have had a different experience in my life. Of my two boys who graduated from Lincoln High School, one of them is at Oregon State, and my other son joined the Marine Corps 1 week after his 18th birthday. Portland Public Schools didn't work for him, although he was a good student. So what we need at the school level is a variety of options.
I'm Wes Soderback, and I'm running for Portland Public School Board, District Number 3. We need to have some cohesiveness to form a society, and so our duties as educators, we need to keep the people informed in order to do